Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. I've been a cop for 27 years. I like to say I got a backstage pass to life. Well, guess what? I got some tickets for you. So come on in, pull up a chair, turn up that volume, and let's go. Chasing Justice is on.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to Chasing Justice. I'm your host, Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. You know, at a time when our law enforcement personnel are under attack like never before, when defunding the police is taking the safety out of our streets, when crime is running wild, I decided to do a long-form interview with Dr. Robert Rail. Dr. Rail is an accomplished author on all things law enforcement. He has served in America as a law enforcement officer, and then he served overseas in Bosnia as an officer teaching the people of Bosnia how to conduct police work. So I don't want to go on too long here, but I think this is an important interview, especially at this day and age. So with me right now is Dr. Robert Rail. Dr. Rail, how are you? Welcome aboard.
It's great to be here, and I thank you, Joe, for what you're doing for all our brothers and sisters in uniform out there.
Well, thank you. It's one of those things that even when you retire, it stays in your blood, and I've been lucky to maintain the ability to teach and train, write a lot of articles, and stay connected. So I kind of see that, and I see you are quite the prolific writer and teacher yourself.
Well, thank you very much. This is part of our responsibility, and it's a pure pleasure with me to give back to the up and coming family of law enforcement that's out there today, which has really got a tough job. But we've always had a tough job, and we're going to overcome everything. But we have to work together as a family in law enforcement to do it.
Well, that's great that you say that, because that's what I say. You know, we went from zeros to heroes and back again, and society is going to change. We saw this defund the police going on last year, and now we're seeing all of these same communities that were saying defund the police, get rid of them, these states, these mayors, all these people are now trying to refund the police and put some money back into it, because the crime has just absolutely gotten out of control. I mean, it's scary in some places where you don't have much of a chance, you know, what you're doing. So why don't you give us some of your background, doctor? You know, where did you work? What did you do? What brought you here to today?
I started out like all of us did. I started out on the street as a street cop. The only thing was I was kind of a rebel. I was dedicated to getting guns and knives off the street. I was dedicated toward I would just lock in on anybody who didn't look back at me. I'd go, what's going on here? You know, reading the body signs from day one was a big one with me. And that's where I gravitated to. And I ended up pulling a lot of guns and knives off the street in my particular area, in the Chicagoland area. That's what happened. And then from there, I ended up writing articles and teaching for Northwestern and a couple of other great schools with their police programs, their police program training. And before I knew it, I retired. And then for some crazy reason that I'm crazy to begin with, I went off to Bosnia with the United Nations police, and I worked with other police, and I was amazed what they knew, and I was amazed what they didn't know. And
who is it you're talking about that did know? Our own men and women that went over there, or the police from those parts of the world in Bosnia?
Well, sometimes they're so filled with hate they can't see. They're blinded by hate. Where I wanted to understand people, and the actual Bosnian police, the Croats, the Serbs, and the Bosniaks, those three fighting groups in there, I had never experienced hate like that. And that's one reason why I wrote the book, Surviving the International War Zone. But with them, I looked at them, and I could see how they responded to me, and I could see what my area was to respond to them. Again, it was body signs. Everything is body signs. Whether people make eye contact with you, whether they stand sideways to you and look in the side eye for deception and concealment, or however, everything that you can imagine, including One pocket on their coat that may hang a little bit low, like something's in it. One cuff on their pants that hangs a little bit low. And then, you know, the pocket in those pants has something heavy in it. See, when people steal a gun, they don't steal a holster. They just put the gun in their pocket and run. Now, a senior officer, they know that. And we have to work with the young rookies. And there's two things that are going to get them in trouble right away. And one is hesitation to act when they should. And the other is not knowing their surroundings, situational awareness. They have to constantly be aware of their situation. You don't look at a car door on your squad when you open it. You get out, you should be looking elsewhere. You don't look down at your holster when you put your weapon back, hopefully. You've done it so many times, you don't have to. So keep your eyes where your eyes belong.
That's really very, very good advice. You know, it's interesting. Years ago, when Commissioner Bernie Kerik wrote his book about his early life in law enforcement, he was a big guns guy, too. He wanted to get guns off the street. And he came up with, I don't know if you've read his book, he came up with a very interesting way to do it. He went to the local gun dealer, gun shop in Manhattan, and he went into the owner and had a nice conversation. He realized that a lot of people that carry guns illegally don't have holsters, like you said, but you know, they don't want to stick them in their waistband. They want to actually get a holster and keep it concealed properly. So he went in and gave them these red plastic bags. And they said, when somebody comes in to buy a holster, and that's all they want is a holster, can you put it in this bag for the sale? And the guy said, sure. So people would come out and there's all blue bags. And here comes out a guy with a red bag. And he would approach him and stop him and talk him. And the guy would go to take off because he had an illegal gun. And boom, he had an arrest. And all of a sudden, he's making tons of these gun arrests. And it was like, it was a really smart way to figure out what the bad guys were doing. So when I see in the piece that I had read from you, the unspoken dialogue, when you're talking about seeing things, it's kind of like what people don't understand when you get, you know, in the TV shows and the movies and all that stuff, you heard, you know, you had your spider senses. Something would just make you feel that something just wasn't right. Well, in law enforcement, we do develop that over time. You know, I remember my training officer telling me he could tell after time a dirtbag in a three-piece suit, because it didn't matter the clothes. It mattered on the way the person reacted. It didn't matter the color of their skin. It depended on how they held themselves, how they walked, the things that they did, the actions that they took. Those were the things that they were talking about that you could identify potentially dangerous people, criminals, people up to no good. It didn't matter anything else, but other than how they behaved. And I think that's the essence of your work here. Am I correct?
I would say you hit that really on the head. And as far as Cleric, that was brilliant with the red bags. But these opportunities, they're all around us. And all we have to do is take advantage of them. I remember I would arrest people, and then I'd hold them on the side and I'd say, okay, you're sitting here, but I'll tell you what I'm going to do for you. I'm going to go out, and if you just talk with me, and not about what you just got arrested for, I checked your sheet. You're into armed robbery. You're in the strong arm. You're into all this stuff. I'll tell you what, I'm going to go out and I'm going to get you cheeseburger and malt and everything. And it goes, okay, you got a deal. So I get the food for him. I get food for me, because when you're interrogating in a friendly way where you get more, then what you do is you do what they do and it'll go a lot better. So he eats and drinks. I eat and drink. So I asked him, I said, how do you know who to strong arm? And he goes, oh, it's easy. I'll go out and I'll sit by a bank and I'll see a woman walk in with a purse. And it's at the end of the court. And she's swinging her purse. She walks into the bank. And then when she walks out of the bank, she's got it tucked up under her arm tight. So I know she's got money in it. I just walk up behind her, hit her in the head, and take the purse and take off. With a guy, the guy is going to walk in. And he'll come out. And he'll constantly be touching where the wallet is to make sure it's there. He'll touch it 2-3 times before he even gets to his car. So I know where he carries his wallet, and I know there's money in it. He said, people tell me. He said, I don't even have to ask. They just tell me. So here I am I'm a street cop and I got all these bad guys and they're telling me, they're saying, I got a gun here. I keep touching it. I keep adjusting it because like what you said, Joe, they don't have a holster most of the time. And even if they do, it's not going to fit right. They're not comfortable with it. We wear it 8, 10, 12 hours a day. We get used to it. They don't. But then also on the other hand, my wife told me, you know what, hun, when you're off duty, you don't swing the one arm, do you?
Right. You know, and that's interesting because, you know, you're hitting on so many points with a lot of the things that I try to teach young officers, seasoned officers, whatever, from based on experience, what I learned and what other people taught me was that I wrote an article for Blue Magazine and it's called Signature Crimes. And really, people are creatures of habit. So even when your wife says you don't swing your right arm, that's because you're prepared to take action. And you think, I put my wallet in my left pocket in the back so that I know I'm right-handed. If I ever have to draw out in plain clothes, I was grabbing that wallet to hold it up so my friendly fire people wouldn't shoot me. So we do adopt all of these kind of different things. But it's just like when you're sitting watching traffic. When people think, you know, you're watching traffic and you'll see cars going by and a car goes by and a car, a junky car, a nice car, this car, and all of a sudden you'll see that one car. Now, it doesn't matter the race of the driver. It doesn't matter the kind of car. Oh, it was a red sports car. None of that matters. You watch that driver. Now, it's normal for people to be nervous around the police. You know, a cop car pulls in behind you, people get nervous. But the innocent person kind of gets over that in a minute. Okay, there's a cop car. No big deal. Somebody is up to no good or has something in their car they shouldn't. You're right. They're going to keep looking in the rearview mirror. They turn and look at you when you're on the side of the road and they give you that horrified look like, oh my God, I'm going to get in trouble now. And those are the cues that we pick up on that people say, oh, you're just chasing people down because you don't like this one or that one. No, we're watching the behaviors of what people do. You know, it's also interesting. I really liked when you were talking about get the guy or a sandwich. I tried to teach when I was in my detective bureau. I tried to teach all of these cops, anytime you brought anybody into the building, no matter what it was, you should talk to them, not necessarily about what they're under arrest for, because they may want to hold back on that. But anybody else, our detectives, I used to say, go in when somebody's under arrest and just, you know, shoot the breeze with them, so have a conversation. We learned more about burglars and how burglars pick their houses that it was amazing. So we'd say exactly what you get them a food, get them a cup of coffee, sit there and BS with them. How did you pick the house you burgled? And just like your guy telling you picking his marks, well, they would tell you, I look for a corner house by the woods. I look for this because I want to do this or I want to do that. And next thing you know, we have a spree of burglaries. And the first thing we would do is make a pie chart and figure out what all these properties have in common. And that would give us a target location to go set up our surveillance. And we call burglars. You know, it's not rocket science, but it is paying attention to human nature. It is listening to what people have to say and asking the right questions.
It's a great thing to do. And it's common sense. You know, I love the Voltaire statement. Voltaire said, common sense is not common. And that was said, hundreds of years ago, but it is so true today. Right. We just have to be communicators. Body language, body science, body gestures, whatever you call it, it's just another form of communication. But for you setting it up and having your detectives interview for a relaxed situation and on a different topic, it's tremendous. It's right where everything should be.
Absolutely. And that's how you gain, a Rolodex in your head of how people behave, what they do, why they do it. So let me ask you this question. You have all this experience in the war zone. You have experience in law enforcement. If we're seeing some of the areas that I concentrate on is safety in schools, you know, school safety for active shooters, workplace violence in businesses, religious facilities, all those kind of things. And we just had a terrorist incident at a religious facility in Texas. If I'm sitting in church or in the mosque, or I'm sitting in the synagogue or wherever I am, and I'm sitting there and I see somebody come in that maybe I don't recognize, they're not from our congregation, and there they come in or they're hanging out by the back door, what am I going to look at to determine if this person maybe has a gun on them, maybe if they have an explosive device? What would I be looking for? Are there any telltale signs that could at least raise my interest that I should maybe take some kind of action?
Let's focus on a main one. This is a critical main one, robotic. They are going to walk in a very, unless they're very war zone savvy, they're going to walk in a very robotic fashion. They will place their feet very carefully. They will go to a certain position. Then they will sit in that position. They will look straight forward. They will be very, very disciplined and robotic in what they do. But I would like to interject something other to this, and that is when you're watching a flow of people walking on a sidewalk, like the Boston bombers, that stood out to me immediately. I'm watching that. You look for those, I call it the bloodstream, because we dealt with a lot of blood overseas everywhere. But we call it the bloodstream. There are those cells that moved a little too quick, and there's those cells that linger. And the main blood flow is moving. Don't watch the main blood flow. Look for those that move a little slow and a little fast, or those that pull off to the side. Don't watch the main flow. They won't be in the main flow. They won't be in the center of it. They'll be on the sides of it. They'll be closer to the buildings. They'll be closer to the street as you see the traffic, the foot traffic flow on a sidewalk. That's more inner city, and that's the way it's going to go. And as getting back to your comment on which was great, on the vehicle, you're in a squad, you're marked, you're uniformed. The average person is just going to look right in their rearview mirror at you. And you can see their eyes are wide, and where a criminal or someone who's about to do something, they're going to glance up, their head won't move. It's going to be fixed. It's going to be locked into their shoulders. You pull up next to them, the side eye is going to come, but the head is not going to turn to look at you. The eyes will move. All these things are triggers. But getting back to your original question, with all due respect, they get very robotic. They just walk in, sit down, and that's it. And you watch them close. Watch the cuffs on their pants. If they're long, they might be having a gun in the pocket. The shirt, the collar, if it's tugged unevenly, there's something in the shirt. Watch everything they do. They'll have a gun, but they won't have a holster. So you've got to key in on this. And what are they looking at? Are they focusing on a person, a place? And what are they carrying? And how do they treat what they carry? I know I'm going on and on here.
No, this is great. This is exactly what I think people need to hear.
But look at what they carry. Do they carry a package like it's a prize position, something very, very, that they have to be very careful with? The average person is going to have packages, and they're going to put them down. They're going to pick them up. They're going to throw them around. But they don't carry them like there's a trigger inside of them. They don't carry them cautiously. And when they put them down, they don't put them against a wall or between their legs. They're guarding them. Watch how they carry a package, because you don't know what's in the package. But if you watch them, they're going to tell you what's in the package.
I found that very interesting in that the unspoken dialogue, body language. Body language is 80% of how we communicate as human beings, and we don't always get to read them. So I'm thinking of what you're saying, and I said, okay, what's a way a young officer could sit out there and say to themselves, all right, I get the whole idea. If I put a gun in my right jacket pocket, it's going to hang down a little more, right? So obviously, I should be looking for that, because look in the mirror. When you put your jacket on to go out, you don't have a gun sitting in your pocket. Your clothes do look kind of normal. You might be a regular disheveled kind of guy, and that's a whole nother person. But the average person, what do? Before you go out, you check yourself, make sure you look nice. You're heading out into the world. So if I would see that hanging down, that would give me a little pause. I would say, okay, that's what Dr. Rail said to look for. Now, what's the context of where I'm at? And start to put these things together. When you were saying about holding on to the package, that's exactly like what you said about somebody coming out of the bank with money. They go in with the purse, no big deal. When they come out, it's full of money. And now we want to hold it close. I know when I go to the airport, and I have to travel somewhere, I bring my backpack because I got like five computers I got to take with me everywhere. And I'm very concerned because you can wait for hours in an airport and I might take a little, I might doze off for a few minutes. I put that thing under my seat between my legs and I press my legs on it tight. So if anybody tried to grab it, I would feel it because it's important to me. And I start looking around and I say, oh, that guy over there, he's worried about it too. Look at him getting ready to take a nap, because I'm a person that looks at these kind of things as well. And you start to make these connections. The other thing that I was saying with signature crimes, you know, I'm writing an article now. I'm putting a piece together now along this line where, you see, we get good at something and we choose to do it over and over again. You know, they say when you're dealing with serial killers, people who are sociopaths, psychopaths that are out there killing people, sexual sadist type of guys and girls, that they make their first mistakes in the beginning as they're learning to do what they want to do, how to do it, how to get away with it, how to plan for it, how to execute it. And they're going to make mistakes in the beginning. So same thing is with burglars or with armed robbers or car thieves. They're going to try and find a way to get into that car quietly, get it started and get them out of there. Burglar's going to find a way to go. We had one series of burglaries, very high-end homes. And again, they were corner lots next to the woods where people couldn't see them. But every time this guy would go in, these wrought iron gates, he would put a little rock in the lock of the wrought iron gate. And we went to these burglaries, and at first we didn't even notice it. We would go checking out. The patrolman checks the outside of the house and says, hey, he got in the back door, but I don't know how he got over that fence. Well, I noticed a rock one time laying there, this little rock laying on the ground. And I said, that's really strange. I think I saw that at one of these other jobs. Well, then eventually we caught the guy. And we're debriefing him and we're talking to him. And I said to him out of the blue, hey, why do you put the locks in the gate or the rocks in the gate? And he starts smiling, shaking his head. He goes, well, I'll tell you what. The first time I did one of them burglaries, the homeowner came home and I couldn't get over that damn fence. And I said, I'm never going to make that mistake again. So that's what he learned. And that's what he did. You know, so it's his signature. He would go around, even in the stupid movie, you know, the Christmas movie, Home Alone, when the idiot's always sticking rags in the sink. He wants to be the wet bandits. You know, he's leaving his calling card. Well, people leave calling cards. They do things the same way over and over and over again. And if you can identify that pattern, because we're all pattern people, we all get up and we all have our own routines in the morning. We do our routines at bed. We're very routine. And a good cop, if you pay attention to those kind of things and look for the commonalities, you can develop a pattern, which then helps you to look forward down the road when you have something going on. Would you agree?
I would say you really hit it on the head with that one, because they're going to have their skill set. They're going to have their abilities. And most of them are not known for having a wide variety of abilities, but they've got one or two things that they're really, really good at. And that's what I tell the young officers today, especially in physical skills of arrest and control, which that was another book I wrote, but in working with different countries, that kind of came up interesting, because the Russian Spetsnaz, which I worked and trained with, they would take one or two skills only, and they would just master the hell out of them. They would just use them incessantly. And then, like the Brits, they would have a different skill for every arrest and control circumstance. And the thing is, under stress, even today, I have moments where with all the garbage I've been into, that stress is a natural thing, and it affects your ability to perform, to do things, to remember. And that's why I would say to people that are involved in physical skills training, learn one or two skills that you can use for many things instead of learning many skills to use for each individual situation. If you taught a person two ways to walk, they would always stumble. We need to get a base, have a certain type of wrist lock that you feel confident with. Use it for everything. Use it for prone position control, standing control, integrated into your mode of handcuffing, everything. Get to be, you know, a mountain lion. I love this example. Is only going to hit you one way. They don't do right cross, left cross, jab, uppercut. They're going to claw you one way, but they really do it well.
Right. And you know, and that goes right to our patterns, right? You find a pattern that works, get really good at it. That's great advice. Now, I know that one of the listings that I see when I look at the multitude of things of which you are an expert at, it's a handcuffing expert. So it's interesting when I create this briefing training, you know, because that's a very valuable time of day for a police officer that usually goes unused. It's not valued for what it is. You know, we talk about, you know, missing persons or a wanted car or, you know, this is what happened on the last shift or whatever. We don't take advantage of that 10 minutes that supervisor, whoever's given that briefing, could use as value time to talk about a policy, a pursuit policy where people get hurt and killed all the time. Go over it, right? But I found I one of the guys that I had was a handcuffing guy. He did a handcuffing class for the police academy. And I said to him, hey, do me a favor. Do you think you could give me five or six things about handcuffing that would be interesting for me to talk to the cops about in the briefing? And he goes, well, first thing is tell them, take their handcuffs out and put some oil in them. Because I'll tell you right now, even cops who make a lot of arrests, they don't ever oil their handcuffs. And I said, you know what? I don't remember oiling my handcuffs and I make a lot of arrests. And it was just one of these common things when it comes to handcuffing, which it can be an area of concern for a police officer in a stressful situation. Is there a technique that they can get a cuff on somebody quickly if somebody's trying to pull away? Is there something that they can do or practice?
Well, absolutely. I'll tell you, I'll make it available to you, and you can make it available to whoever you choose as a gift. To everyone else. That's the position I'm in now. I'm comfortable. Everything is good. But when you handcuff, unless it's a real bizarre circumstance, handcuff only one way. If you handcuff only one way, you will continually get better and better and better to the point where people will stand around and go, oh, you got to watch this. I mean, it's so quick and it's mm-hmm. so smooth, and it's not like in the movies or on TV where they cut away for a moment and then all of a sudden they walk them off handcuffed. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. They can't do it. They don't know how, and they fumble. But if you do it one way, you'll get nothing but better. Right. And within a matter of months, you'll be like a rodeo cowboy. You'll be the most brilliant person subduing people that there is.
Right. And that prevents a lot of violence. If you get somebody under control quickly, you know, cuff then search, securing people, you know, if you got to do a doso because, you know, you had to control them so they don't, you know, dust them off, send them on their way. At least if you're in your rights to cuff them, doing it quickly, doing it safely, provides
it's
the officer
with
everybody.
Safety.
It's better for everybody. Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's great advice when it comes to it. Now, I remember we went from when I first came on, we had the PR-24, the baton, you know, the side handle baton.
Yes.
And boy, I'll tell you, being a non-cop going through the academy, that looked to me like the coolest tool in the world. We're doing, you know, these the swings, we're doing the chops, we're doing all this stuff. Then you get out in the road, you don't see anybody ever do, you know, the Georgia State Police takedown with this thing. You see people whack somebody with the stick in the leg so that they grab their leg and you can jump on them. And sometimes we can overdo things like that. And this is what I'm getting from what you're saying, if we don't practice specific things, we're trying to learn everything about how to use this baton like you're a martial arts major, when maybe you really need to know how to do that arm lock with the baton or the asp or whatever that they're carrying now. Get really good with that one piece of equipment so that it helps you and it's not just in your way. I remember we had a guy he must have been on some kind of drugs, and he was crazy in this food store. He was smashing the place, and my partner and I go in there and he wants to fight with us, and I'm ready to do the cross draw, and I'm going to do this. And he just took the stick and hit him in the stomach with it. And the guy bent over and he handcuffed him. And he says, listen, he says to me, listen, kid, You know, that stuff's all great, but there's a place for it. Sometimes you just got to, you know, take them out of action so you can control it. So I think your point there is really good.
I think, you know, going back to basis, the basic things are always critically the best. And getting back to, I made an original comment there. I blurted out a wrist lock, a wrist hold. Well, the thing is, we can, the greatest tools that we have is what we are, our own bodies. Our hands are always with us. And if we master out, we get really, really skillful in a wrist lock or in some type of a technique. This is always with us. It's not something we have to make space for on a gun belt, which we don't have enough room for anyway. And if we get any more equipment on these gun belts, it's going to be more and more about less and less until we have everything for nothing. We're playing around with so much equipment now, and it's good equipment. There's a lot of good equipment, and it's got good uses. But it's like the old situation with the samurai. You go up to a samurai, and if all of a sudden they don't have a sword, they're not harmless. They're not going to be harmless. And you can't just walk up and grab them by the neck and say, come here.
Right. Hey, thank goodness he doesn't have his sword. I guess I'll take over. Doc, I got to tell you, this is a very interesting conversation. The content is great for the officers and everybody else that's listening out there. We're going to take a little bit of a break, and we'll be back in 1 minute.
Trouble getting to sleep and staying asleep can be infuriating. Your mind races. You toss and turn, and the harder you try, the harder it is to drift off. And today's digital age makes it even harder. You're not alone with this struggle. Poor sleep affects over 70% of Americans. Even the Centers for Disease Control label insufficient sleep a public health epidemic. To take back your sleep, Healthy Cell has created REM Sleep, the only sleep supplement made to support all four stages of human sleep with calming herbs, amino acids, and sleep hormone support, delivered in a patent-pending, pill-free, ultra-absorption microgel formula that tastes great. Fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deeply, and wake up refreshed with Healthy Cell's REM Sleep. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
As Americans, we seek to form a more perfect union. To paraphrase Abraham Lincoln, we are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And God willing, we shall not perish from the earth. AmericaOutLoud.com. Liberty and justice for all.
All right, everybody, welcome back. I'm here with Dr. Robert Rail, author of multiple books, the Unspoken Dialogue. Doc, what are some of your other books that are out there for people that might want to pick these up and read them?
Well, I'll tell you what. I wrote a couple of books for a great publisher called Viral Press, VARROPRESS.com. And they've got a book on handcuffing that I wrote. They've got another book on handcuffing from a prison perspective, second book. And they also are the ones who carry the Unspoken Dialogue. Another book that I wrote was when I came back from serving in Bosnia and Kosovo, and then Iraq, was surviving the international war zone, and that's actual stories. As the Arabs would say, "This I have seen with my own eyes." So I was there. You know, I was involved.
And there's nothing more important than experience. And I could tell you that as a young cop, when I came out, I never planned to be a cop. That wasn't my life goal. I ended up working for, believe it or not, for a private investigator and finding out, boy, this is really, I really enjoyed this. And my wife says to me one day, hey, they're hiring police officers in this town. Why don't you go try out? You like that? And I took it. And I tell you, it was the greatest career I could have ever had. I spent most of my time in the detective bureau and then in supervision, but I loved every minute of it. But when I look back, it was the men and women who had great experience on the job, no matter what it was, that had great experience, that were willing to pass it on, that, you know, you would just, you should suck it up like a sponge. You know, they tell you in any organization or anything you join, when you first go in, keep your mouth shut and your ears open. And I'm sure you've seen the same thing I have. You get these young guys and girls that are cocky. They think they know everything. And instead of learning, they're making lots of mistakes they don't have to make. So your experience is amazing for everybody. And that's why I suggest everyone go get these books. You know, you're sitting in a patrol car. It's a good idea to read. And while we're talking about it, I'll tell you to go get my book, too.
Okay, great.
My book is I'm from Loose Leaf Law. It's called The Interview, and it is basically one of my favorite things that I've developed over the years is talking with people. I think interviewing people is probably one of the most amazing things you can do in law enforcement. You know, you see people that we had a detective that would walk into the room, an old school guy, and he would yell at the suspect, "You better tell the truth. You're going to get this. You're going to get." And nobody ever talked to this guy, really. They would give him a little something. Maybe an 18-year-old scared kid would say something. But once I started watching the really talented men and women who would come in, and like you were saying earlier, engage in a conversation, have a cup of coffee, talk to somebody, you start to realize that it's about building a bond. Now, it's a short-time bond, and it's not being your best friends you're going to go out to dinner when the arrest is over, but you connect with that person on some level that they see you as a lifeline. I'm in big trouble here. I know I'm in trouble and I can connect to this cop and I'm telling the truth. And, you know, I trust that he'll do the right thing or she'll do the right thing. So I wrote this entire lesson plan and I teach this interview class. And I said, wait a minute, why don't I see if I could put this in book form? So I did. And the publisher liked it. And it's out there. It's called The Interview. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it anywhere. It's not really a commercial, but it's a great thing to do to write down your experience and pass it on so that, you know, these cops get sitting in a patrol car with nothing to do, get a book, learn from somebody like Dr. Rail, who's actually, as he said, he's done some things. He's been there, right? So I think this is really important. Now, when you look at like body language during an interview, okay, if I'm sitting there talking with somebody, what are some of the things I might see if they're being deceptive to me in body language?
Well, a lot of times you're going to look at their face and you're going to see they're going to punctuate everything they say with a smile. They're going to make a comment, and if they're trying to con you, it's going to be a big smile. But their mouth will smile. Their eyes won't. Their eyes will be cold. Their eyes will be dead. It's going to be a big, stupid grin. And there's no difference between the smile and like they're getting ready to bite. The other thing you're going to notice is as you're talking with them and you make a point, are they leaning away from you or are they leaning toward you? Are they leaning forward in their chair? If they are, they're kind of accepting what you're saying a little bit. Watch the body position of the upper body. Is it leaning toward you or is it leaning away from you? Now, we all talk about folded arms. A lot of people, they're just more comfortable with their arms folded. They're just more comfortable sitting with their legs crossed. But watch the body mechanics when they actually lean forward. And also, a lot of times, they'll say things very clear, but they'll say things quietly, which is a lot more sincerity. And again, watch out for the robotics. There's the natural robotic answer. Yes, I wasn't there. I don't know that. But then all of a sudden the tone changes. They get a little quieter. They may even lean forward and they may look away from you, but they'll say something. Pick up on that. Always pick up on that. Now, and a real good tool of investigation. I even had the Russians laughing at the United Nations police training that I did. Ask the questions where you already know the answers. You know a lot about them already. Ask them a question. See if they're lying to you about what you know to be true. And then go back at them and look at them and go, you know, I really think you're telling me the truth. Because it's what they call a walking con. It leads to other things. And this is what you want to do. It's like what you said, Joe. You're building a relationship. It may be short term, but you're building a relationship. And once you get one bite into them, into their mind where, well, I trust, you know, they told you the truth. You said, I know you told me the truth. And they're going, how the hell does he know? Okay. Maybe he just trusts me. Maybe he knows. Well, okay. I want them to be in doubt. And just let it slowly grow.
Right. One of the things that I talk about that I noticed early on that I started to watch that became very important for me when dealing with anybody, even as dreaded as this job was in internal affairs, when you had to talk to an officer about something maybe they did or didn't do, was the whole concept of cognitive dissonance. You know, if I'm telling the truth, if my story I'm about to tell you is truthful, it will make sense. It will fit together. Now, no matter how convoluted the facts are, if I'm telling the truth, it all fits together really nicely. And it comes together as a nice piece of story. I can verify things. That's all really good. But when you see people all of a sudden start to develop cognitive dissonance, cognitive for thinking, dissonance for disarray, and they tell you their name, they tell you where they are. You know, I set up a couple of minutes before the actual interview to talk about anything but the crime. I want to see how they look at me. Do they look me in the eye when they answer? Are they relaxed? Are they breathing normal? Are they answering quickly? Are they thinking about their answer? And then when we transition into talking about what they may have done, you know, the crime that's taken place, now you see that cognitive dissonance. You'll start to see they're thinking, they're trying to figure out, where am I going? What do I know already? What can they not give me to lead them back to them? And you'll see stumbled sentences. I was at work. That's what I was at work all morning, as opposed to, yeah, I took the bus. I got off. I walked to that 7-Eleven. I didn't rob that 7-Eleven. And then I went to my office, as opposed to, well, I'm not sure. I think I took the bus. And, you know, there was lots of people out. And then I ended up at my office and I didn't see anything. When I start to hear that cognitive dissonance, that's a direct sign for me, like body language, certain things that they'll do, body language, that say there's something wrong here. That's not correct the way they're behaving. And it just tells me, go back and ask more questions. Because maybe you found this. I know I did. I wrote an article for Blue Magazine also called Curiosity. One of the most important characteristics an officer can have is to be curious about things. Why is that person standing there? Why did they say that? Why did they go to the back of that building in the middle of the night? You know, those kind of things. You got to be curious about what people do and why, if you're going to investigate things. Would you agree?
Absolutely. A lot of times those little questions, those little ideas, they spark. They spark an idea in your mind, and you need to follow up on those little things because they lead you to everything else.
I know that I've seen video of inmates practicing disarming techniques on each other so that when they get out, they get really good at this to disarm officers. I've interviewed them where the minute you get out of your patrol car or you show up on the scene, they start to evaluate you. Is this somebody I could beat in a fight? Is this somebody I could run away from? Is this somebody I could attack and win? Are there any pre-attack kind of movements you would look at before somebody may come at you, whether you walk up on them or you surprise them somewhere? Are there any pre-attack kind of physical movements or things we should be looking for?
Absolutely. Let me break this down and I'll try and go through these. This is really substantial. But one is if they look and they make direct eye contact with you, they're looking directly into your eyes and you see them square off. You see them, if they're right-handed, they're going to drop their right foot back slightly. They can't go forward without a foot back. That's a martial arts principle. If they're going to move on you quick, they got to have that brace foot back. Another thing that you want to watch out if they look at your radio, because then they want to know, is he going to call backup? And if you reach for the radio, a lot of times they're going to reach for it and try and stop you from calling for backup. Another deadly sign is if they start staring at your weapon. If they start staring at your weapon, they look at it, then they look in your eyes, and you see their eyes just trigger down on the weapon, like staccatically, just a couple of times. That's a deadly sign, a very deadly sign. But through all of this, you must maintain your distance from them. If you can reach out and touch them, they can reach out and kill you. You have That's to maintain great. Your distance. It's critical. It's your life. It's everything. Now, another thing that people don't realize, our brothers and sisters in uniform, you've got to watch your partner. If you see somebody doing these signs, if you see somebody staring at your partner's weapon, at their radio, or moving slightly in on them and covering that distance, that close distance, that's another critical sign. Then you move and you just divert them. They're not going to handle, catch two off guard like catching one off guard. That's not going to happen.
We don't like to look at incidents where officers get hurt and killed because nobody wants to say anything negative about a brother or sister who got hurt or killed. But I think we have to look at every one of those incidents and compare them to a matrix and go, okay, not to bring any negativity on the officer, but so that we can all learn, were there signs here that we can see that if somebody else is going to do it, we can learn from that experience and maybe keep our distance, back off, take a safe place, retreat to the car, whatever it is we need to do, because we learn. Here's the set of facts that happened in this case. I'm a big proponent of telling people a lot of stories in my training, to pass on stories.
Got it.
And I don't pass them on so they'll say, Lieutenant Joe, what a fantastic career you had. I pass them on the good and the bad. I tell them where I screwed up because nobody ever does that. Nobody tells you where they screwed up. I tell them where I screwed up because I want them to learn. Here's what happened to me and here's the mistakes I made. Don't you make those mistakes. Or at least if you see the situation starting to develop, like in my story, and I went wrong, maybe you need to think a little bit more about what you're doing, and kind of protect yourself. So all of this stuff is extremely important to the men and women that are out there. The job has never been more dangerous than it is today. It's unbelievable. I mean, back in the day when I was a cop, you had officers who were killed in the line of duty, responding to a robbery call or doing something like that. You didn't have cops killed eating a sandwich in their cop car. People didn't just walk up and shoot them. Eddie Burns was one of the first ones in New York City protecting or watching a drug dealer's house, and somebody walked up and killed him. And that was shocking. That was absolutely shocking because it just didn't happen. Now it happens a lot. What do you see there with the changes went from when you were starting to the atmosphere that our cops have to work in now?
I think it's societal. I think it's a really disgusting situation. Let me say this. I've said it before on campus at universities, and I'll say it here. It was many, many years ago, over 100 years ago, they had the classifications of the mental classifications of idiot, imbecile, and moron. And right now, I would say that those are applicable for most of the politicians out there. I have nothing good to say about I'm very upset with our legal system. It's not a justice system. It's a legal system. We have to be knowledgeable. We have to be on top of it. We have to be sharp because we not only have to perform to a high professional standard for our own safety on the street as police, but we have to be skilled and knowledgeable in court. We have to have our ears up. We have to be ready for being submarined and hurt by politicians who are not treating us right, not treating us in an appropriate manner, getting away with saying absolutely horrendous, dangerous, and disgusting things about our brothers and sisters, where we have to take protection legally, and we have to take protection through excellent training, and we have to be there, and we have to be there for each other also. This recent situation where this police officer, she discharged a weapon instead of discharging a taser. She yelled, "Taser, taser, taser." She discharges a weapon. That clearly wasn't the situation in court. She wasn't, the representation was not appropriate. And also the way the car stopped was not appropriate. He should have been removed from the car. And then, like what you do, Joe, and what I do for many years, taken to the back of the car. You don't let a person stand next to the driver's seat. You know they're going to jump back in the vehicle. Right. Always.
You know, when we look at that, and that's a good example, that female officer there, this has become so politically charged that for people to look at that and to watch the video of this woman who was actually, she was being a training officer, and people say, "Oh, how can you not know the difference between a taser and a handgun?" Well, let me tell you something.
Stress.
You put all that stuff on your belt. You go out there in a situation where people want to kill you and are doing terrible things, and you have that stress. And then you react in a situation like that. Obviously, she thought she was using a taser. Was she wrong? Yes. Is it horrific that person, no matter what he had done in life, ended up dead? It is. But was her intent to kill anybody? It was not. Her intent clearly was to use a non-lethal weapon to put this dangerous person under control and get them out of there. And unfortunately, a terrible, terrible tragedy took place. And this is where, if we looked at things realistically, we would say we demand that these officers are out there, society. Right. These are not just rogue men and women who decide, "I'm going to go out and do what I want to do." We put them there because we demand that there be laws and that we live in an orderly society. So we have laws from our legislature, and then we have people charged to go out and enforce those laws so that we can all live a good, decent life. Those are our law enforcement people. And I'll tell you, it's one of the only businesses where when things go sideways, it can be deadly serious for anybody involved, including the officer or the people we're dealing with. If a plumber makes a mistake, God bless the plumbers. We can't function without them. But if they cut a pipe, you get a wet mess and you fix it. When something goes sideways on a cop, the officer can end up seriously injured or dead, and the person they're dealing with can too. And that's a terrible thing, but that's a reality. We can't pretend that these cops are just going, "Hey, let's just go arrest that guy." You know, I'm sure you had these meetings in your police department where we all got together in the morning. Who are we going to pick on today? Who do you want to pick on today? Let's go get these guys. That's what people think we do. That's not what happens. And that's because it's been so politicized. You see an officer who made a terrible mistake. It's exploited for political purposes that you see the whole Ferguson effect taking place. You see cops backing off of being proactive. And I'm going to ask you this. My opinion is that proactive police work is all that keeps our society together and keeps people safe. What do you think?
I could not possibly agree with you more than everything begins and ends with proactivity. If you don't get out there and start turning over the rocks, you're not going to find anything going on. All you're doing is giving the criminal element time to hurt more victims. We have to be proactive, and we have to be proactive in our training, and we have to develop a society. We have to re-educate the society as to what we are actually doing on the street, so that when these politicians make these heinous, horrible remarks that are just absolutely off the wall, that the citizenry will stand up and go, "No, you're disgusting. We don't need you in our society. We don't need you in our political positions. You're detrimental, and you're encouraging more victims to suffer.
Political points of view like that are deadly for not just for the cops, but for society. Look at the way criminals are emboldened now because of all of these prosecutors saying, you know, maybe if we just back off putting everybody in jail, everyone will just behave themselves and not rob and rape everybody to death. Now, is that what's actually taking place in our big cities, that they're backing off and the crime is going down and it's a safer place for everyone? And it's just, that's absurd. And we see it because they're trying to make political points. I don't know with who. To say the prosecutor in New York, I'm not going to prosecute almost all of our crimes, murder, but I'm not asking for any more than 20 years. What are you talking about? You know what? You're giving people a green light to go out and rob a store with a gun, stick a gun in somebody's face. As long as they don't shoot the gun, it'll be a misdemeanor. Well, how many times do you think people are now going to go out, stick guns in people's faces, and in a confrontation, somebody's going to end up dead only because they said, well, I'm just going to go scare them and take the money. And people are going to end up dead. Society is going to suffer from this backing off, this attack of our law enforcement people. Conversely, I will say, we do have to make sure that within our own ranks, we do the right thing. We treat people with respect. We treat people with dignity. We are fair in how we use discretion. One of the most powerful things a law enforcement officer has is discretion. And make sure we use it fairly. Make sure that we're appropriate in what we're doing. But cops are not out in the field to get hurt, shot, and punched in the face. That's not the rule. We are out there to enforce the laws society demands. And that's what we're doing. And when you go after these cops just willy-nilly to shut them down, they're going to back off. And when they back off, you and your family are in danger. And people really don't quite get that, but I think they're getting it now.
I think they are too. I think the pendulum has swung, it's close to as far as it's going to swing, and then it's got to swing back because this is just insanity in society.
Yep. Well, that's my term, heroes to zeros and back again. You know, they always come back because society needs us. You know, law enforcement is a very noble profession. Do we have a couple of people who shouldn't be in there? Yes, we have to weed them out before they're hired. And we have to remove them if they demonstrate they should not have the responsibility of being a law enforcement officer. But those are far and few between in people. And I'm sick of people saying, you know, painting with the only group you can paint with a broad brush in this country is law enforcement. You know, they're all like this and everybody accepts that. And that's not how they are. These are young men and women that go through their lives dedicating themselves, virtually putting their lives on the line. And in many cases, sacrificing themselves at the altar of freedom for everybody in this country to do the right thing. And we're attacking them. And I think it's going to come back. It has to start coming back because we can't, this is not sustainable to live like this.
No, it's not. And Joe, just a brief shout out while I'm thinking of it to all of you out there, all my very young brothers and sisters in uniform. I am so proud of you. And Joe is so proud of you, of what you're doing. Hang in there. Stay with your senior partners. Stay with your junior partners. Stay with the law enforcement family. We respect you. You are respected. You're just doing a phenomenal job, and you are in our hearts and you are in our minds.
Doctor, thank you very much. I think you summed up this entire conversation beautifully. So I'm going to say to everybody out there, law enforcement, corrections, anybody that's listening to what we're talking about, people that care about a safe and orderly society, go out and get Dr. Rail's books. Go to varopress.com, varopress.com. Get his books, look for his articles. And I want to thank you very much for being here, doctor. And I say to everybody out there, remember, be a part of the solution and not a part of the problem. It's worth fixing. It's worth saving. We're all in this together. This is Lieutenant Joe, and we'll talk to you next time.